In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. The relentless, hypnotic effects of the mainstream media continue to entrain minds through falsehoods, repetition, and teaching to process information through emotion instead of the intellect. In the last few years, there have been comments from listeners who were upset about guests questioning the official story of the attacks on September 11, 2001, the Sandy Hook shooting, and the Boston Marathon bombing. The comments were emotional responses without direct criticism of specific content. It's noteworthy to point out that responses such as horrified and upset, while valid in their own right, don't address facts and evidence. I suspect reporters could be seen as aiding a potential cover-up when they yield to emotional sensitivity surrounding a shooting event or any potential false flag, especially if it's wrongly used as a shield to condemn any questioning beyond the official investigation. But as Professor Eric Larson points out, yielding to this pressure create the serpent songs in American journalism and literature. The State News reported on April 15, 2013, that two pressure cooker bombs exploded near the Boston Marathon finish line at approximately 2:49 p.m. Eastern. Three people were reported killed and an estimated 264 injured. The bombs exploded about 13 seconds and 210 yards apart near the finish line on Boylston Street. There were many high-definition images of the explosions and aftermath available to the public. Similar to the Sandy Hook shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, the speculation and alternative theories running counter to the official narrative saturated online media. Well, 3 years later, a detailed analysis of the Boston Marathon bombing was posted online. The powerful documentary titled The Boston Unbombing draws from a pictorial record taken almost second by second. It also uses video showing clear detail of devices and techniques normally deployed in disaster simulations. The narrator explores how the event was a carefully coordinated drill presented to all as a genuine terrorist attack. We're going to hear from some of this documentary. We'll also hear from the late David McGowan, author of the book Programmed to Kill, and the book Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. We also hear from past guest Professor Eric Larson, editor and publisher of the Oliver Arts and Open Press, a novelist and writer. He is the author of A Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit, and the book The Skull of York, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Grave Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. The Boston Unbombing documentary calls the Boston Marathon bombing a disaster preparedness drill gone live, which was carried out by people within various federal and local government agencies that have been involved in running mega disaster preparedness drills across America for years now. The documentary focuses on the first explosion site near the finish line because of the availability of high-quality photographic and video footage. Essentially, throughout the whole documentary, the explosions are referred to as pyrotechnic displays. Like many staged events and false flags, a rigorous examination processed through a calm, rational mind can reveal important anomalies. For example, almost 2 hours after the winner crosses the finish line, there is a group of mainstream media cameramen still there, eagerly poised. The implication is that they're in on it. How can that be, you ask? Well, Operation Mockingbird is generally defined as a large-scale program of the United States Central Intelligence Agency that began in the early 1950s attempting to manipulate news media for propaganda purposes. The Boston unbombing documentary uses the finish line clock to help sequence some of the photos taken from different sources. There are two sets of photographs taken from nearby windows. One is called the Thorndike set. The other is from Aaron Tang, who goes by Haha Tango on Flickr. With this, let's hear the first audio clip describing the initial scene of the aftermath.
This photo captures exactly 1 minute and 38 seconds after the first pyrotechnic display, before anyone was taken out of the area by wheelchair or by stretcher. Note that there is actually not a lot of people on the scene in this photo. Altogether, at the first pyrotechnic site, there were 27 victims lying or sitting down on the ground, appearing to be injured. Not all of them clearly visible in this photo, of course. Plus, there were a number of people who stayed standing and walking around at the site and were later reported as injured. Plus, there were a number of people who ran away from the site very soon after the pyrotechnic display, or possibly were never near the site at all and were later reported as injured. And at the second pyrotechnic display site, a block down the street, there was a much smaller amount of victims. We will soon be discovering that all of these victims are actually crisis actors. Now, when I say crisis actors, I don't mean professional actors or professional crisis actors. I mean people of various professions and walks of life who were recruited to be crisis actors in this particular event. Though most of our focus will be on the first site, here is the site of the second pyrotechnic display, which is a block further back from the finish line than the first site. The alleged epicenter of the alleged blast, aka Ground Zero, in this picture, is between the tree and the dark green mailbox. This photo was taken 13 seconds after the second pyrotechnic display. The picture is grainy, but there are several so-called victims on the ground between the mailbox and the tree. There are several more to the left of the tree and behind the barricade fencing on the left. Altogether, there's around a dozen so-called victims near Ground Zero in this scene. But the stage of the second pyrotechnic site was wider than just the immediate area around Ground Zero. By the time this photo was taken, there were a number of so-called victims who were taken away or ran away from the immediate area of Ground Zero. Plus, there are some so-called victims who show up in the media footage who were probably never close to Ground Zero at all. From all the available footage, there are no more than 24 crisis actor victims on the entire stage of the second pyrotechnic display, which is to say nothing of their accomplices, the crisis actor heroes, the people who played the roles of the uninjured helpers. So, the official story is that there were 264 people injured at the Boston so-called bombing. But in reality, they kept the number of crisis actor victims a lot smaller than that. The number of crisis actor victims between both sites was somewhere around 70 people. And I should mention that quite a few of them appear to have missed out on the injury makeup and fake blood. Anyhow, there was certainly nowhere near 264 crisis actor victims, and there was zero real victims, because the entire event and all its transpirings was not real. But before we go into the particular transpirings of the Boston unbombing, we have to have full context. But what's the use of telling you that the Boston unbombing was a large disaster drill gone live if you don't know what a large disaster drill looks like, and what types of participants and props and effects are typically in use therein? In order to have the necessary context, we have to go over some of the basic elements of large disaster and emergency response training drills. So here we go. Even crisis actors get a coffee break. These are crisis actors at a recent large disaster drill in England. Fake wounds and fake gore are called moulage in the special effects industry, and are an element of hyper-realistic emergency response drills. Moulage is our word for the day. Here's some more media coverage of the same drill in England. Lots of actors, lots of moulage. That cut leg looks like it hurts. Moulage is an art. Here's an amateur homemade moulage wound, made of various silicones and putties and paints. The funny comment says she's going to pick the kids up from school with that on her arm. Not bad for an amateur. Now let's see some work from the pros. Pretty realistic and pretty gross. This is professional work by the UK-based firm Trauma FX. Gag me with a spoon. And more from Trauma FX. Grody to the max. And more from Trauma FX, using an amputee crisis actor. I really don't like looking at this. This is just a palate cleanser after that last image. This is an advertisement for silicone sleeves with prefabricated wounds. Silicone sleeves and silicone skin wraps and silicone patches are common elements in emergency response drills, as well as movie special effects makeup. Here's a different silicone sleeve you can buy from the same company. Collect all 12. But you should also get a fake blood pump kit if you're going to do the job professionally. Notice in the picture at the top that the fake wound is bleeding. Of course it is. Bleeding is an important part of trauma simulation. Why not visit Etsy and get yourself a silicone trauma simulation sleeve with a dynamic bleeding tube included? As the description says, this sleeve works with a HydraSim. And here's the HydraSim trauma bleeding simulation system. It's basically a small pack containing a fake blood supply and a pumping mechanism and some tubes. The ad reads, "A rugged, realistic, and affordable solution to the chaos caused by external hemorrhage." The three photos at the bottom are a few of the more sophisticated fake bleeding rigs on the market. Some of them are battery-operated. The photo at the top is an emergency training company advertising the simulation effect of fake blood squirting frighteningly from a fake leg wound. You might have noticed the word squib under one of the pictures here. Squib is a word used for fake blood packets in the field of trauma simulation and also in the movie special effects industry. Any professional emergency response drill or military drill makes use of fake blood in a variety of forms. Blood capsules, blood sponges, blood syringes, and blood squibs. A simple blood squib is a pouch designed to break with impact, and we've already seen some of the more complex squibs on the market. There are all kinds of squibs using various kinds of pump and tube assemblies. This is an article from Fox News about the benefits of hyper-realistic medical emergency training. The article reads, quote, "Makeup artists create combat wounds that bleed actively from hidden tubes," unquote. At the right is a still frame from the video accompanying this article, and it shows a crisis actor using the fake blood delivery system. I'm sure you get the point by now. But here's another product that includes a tube that sends fake blood squirting out of a gruesome moulage wound. Of course, you'd probably want to hide the tube a bit better than that in a disaster drill or a trauma simulation drill. Now, if you're doing an emergency drill, you don't really need a super-duper realistic silicone moulage sleeve, nor would you need a particularly deceptively hidden fake blood tube delivery system. The photo at the top is a demo of a fake blood tube simply tucked under a flesh-colored sleeve and simulating bleeding through some holes in the sleeve. That wouldn't pass in a Hollywood movie. The silicone sleeve on the bottom, on the other hand, is quite convincing. You can hardly see the edges. Sneak a fake blood tube under there, and you're ready for the big screen. As for the Boston Unbombing was not quite ready for the big screen. Remember I told you about the Thorndike set of photos? This is Thorndike 7, capturing 5 seconds after the pyrotechnic display. Now we'll magnify the area of the picture where the blue arrow is pointing. This fellow was a crisis actor named Eric Whaley, who, according to the official story, had his pants blown off by a shrapnel-filled bomb. We see no evidence from this angle that his legs are bleeding. We do, however, see an anomalous line all the way across the top of his left thigh, which is direct evidence, as several more photographs over the next several slides will prove, that he is wearing a thin silicone sleeve over his upper left thigh. The photo on the right has the contrast enhanced in order to see the line on his thigh more clearly. Just to help you out, on the photo on the left, I drew a blue line over the line across his thigh. Just to be extra clear, the area now colored green is where the silicone sleeve is pulled up over his upper thigh. Okay, please understand that I'm not asking you to come to a conclusion from this photo alone. I will soon be showing you other photos, including a very clear high-resolution close-up of this silicone sleeve over his upper thigh, with a fake blood tube under it. But our purposes for now are just to establish that this line around his leg was there immediately after the pyrotechnic display. Here's another photo showing us another angle. Yet again, his legs aren't bleeding, and now we see from another angle that the same line that we saw across the top of his thigh is also going around his inner thigh. So we know it is something he is wearing around his leg. As we've established, silicone sleeves and coverings are commonly used in the field of special effects makeup. But of course we should be asking all the logical questions at this point. We should ask if this line is some kind of shrapnel gash across his leg. But if that was the case, then he would be bleeding here at 5 seconds after the pyrotechnic display. And he is not bleeding, and that line across his leg is not a wound. He rolls around a bit, and we don't get too many good pictures of this leg in the Thorndike set, and this one is a bit out of focus, but nonetheless it clearly shows us again that anomalous line on his left thigh. This picture was taken several minutes later. Now Mr. Whaley has been moved several feet away from where he was, and he is in the process of being tended to by the first responder special effects makeup team. And there's that same line around his left thigh. I put a close-up on the upper right and a close-up with contrast enhanced on the lower right. Now, for the kids in the back of the class, I'll draw a blue line over the line around his leg. There it is. And there it is, clear as day. Notice how the large red stain is coming from under that line on his thigh.
You're listening to the first deep analysis of the Boston Marathon bombing. As you'll hear, the narrator will be describing the equipment used in the emergency training industry to create fake wounds and bleeding. In the photos being described, you can actually see the tube wrapped around the leg oozing red liquid. Another important detail captured in the documentary is how some of the actors have sliced open pants. Let's hear more about that.
For the next several slides, I'm going to focus on evidence of clothing cut in a scissors or razor type way, with unbleeding skin underneath, which is impossible to be the result of a shrapnel bomb. For starters, here's a real oddball from the second pyrotechnic site. This fellow is named Bim Costello. The vertical cuts in his shirt are ridiculous. Real bomb shrapnel goes through fabric, making holes in clothing, and results in much traumatic bleeding when it does so. Shrapnel does not cut a shirt like scissors, but scissors do. His pants are supposed to be blown apart by a shrapnel-filled bomb, but while he is marked up, there is zero sign of him actually bleeding. This photo is just ridiculous. Speaking of clothing being cleanly sheared, here is a photo from the first pyrotechnic site. Here we see a fat lady in a purple shirt exiting the scene less than a half a minute after the pyrotechnic display, with scissors in her hand. The woman in the red shirt next to her is her accomplice. I call them the cutting crew. Here's a close-up. In this photo, the scissors are closed. In the next photo, they're open. This guy has recently met with some scissors. The two photos on the left are from the Thorndike set, and we see this fellow's pants neatly sliced open just a few seconds after the pyrotechnic display. The two photos on the right are from Ha Ha Tango and show him minutes later displaying the tailoring for a cop. He told ABC News that his jeans were blown apart by a bomb. His name is Colton Kilgore. Yes, I see the reddish color of his right leg on the picture at the right, and I've already established that fake blood abounded that day. It is the absolutely kooky, crazy cutting of his pants that I'm pointing out as an impossible result of a shrapnel bomb. Let's listen to him.
I am, and as you can see, there are my jeans that were blown apart, and this is the strip that I was trying to tear off to use as a tourniquet.
Still Boston strong, he hopes his testimony painted a picture of the bloodshed.
You know, it was really an honor to
to get to represent my fellow survivors.
Okay. So he actually wants us to believe that his jeans were blown apart like this by a shrapnel bomb. Again, in the photos at the bottom, we see in the Thorndike pictures from around 6 seconds after the pyrotechnic display that ridiculous cut in his jeans, with no bleeding skin underneath.
For some reason, it had taken 3 years for someone to see this level of detail and produce this video documentation. Does it remind you of another powerful forensic analysis of a staged event? I would answer yes. It's similar to Dr. Judy Wood's book, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. Specifically, the similarity is in how the available video and photographs have been analyzed. In the Boston unbombing, through this analysis, you are shown how the random victims and bystanders are not so random. It then becomes clear they are performing their roles. We heard the narrator describe Mr. Whaley being attended to by the first responder special effects makeup team. It's all in the photos. When you're shown what to look for, it's shockingly obvious. There were others with fake blood tubes tucked around their bodies. The narrator describes how Jeff Bowman was already a double amputee, and that photographic evidence reveals tubes coming out of the back of his pants. Jeff, for some reason, waited for tourniquets and a wheelchair while surrounded by medical doctors and EMS. Let's hear more from this narrator in the Boston unbombing, analyzing that photographic detail.
Now we'll follow Carlos and Jeff through the extensive photographic and video footage. The evidence will reveal that the official story of Carlos and Jeff is in fact just a lie, and that Carlos and Jeff are but two members of a larger cast of crisis actor victims and pretend heroes and make-believe bystanders, all carrying out their given roles. Let's begin following Carlos with the first of many photos from the Ha Ha Tango set, showing his actions at the scene. Here Carlos is jumping over the fence. We also want to know where Jeff is on this stage. See where the blue line shows a brick-paved section of the sidewalk? Jeff is on the bricks in front of the black lamp post, as the next slide will reveal. The Thorndike set of photos shows us exactly where Jeff is. This photo is from the Thorndike sequence and captures 7 seconds after the pyrotechnic display. Jeff is circled. You can see his leg stumps up in the air. Looking from the street, he is in front of the black lamp post on the paved brick section, where the left edge of the bricks meets the cement sidewalk, as highlighted by the blue arrow. Now that we know where Jeff is, let's get back to following Carlos. Carlos moving scaffolding at 2 minutes and 10 seconds after. Remember that Dr. Panter and the EMT were already over Jeff at 1 minute after the pyrotechnic display. Now on this photo, at 2 minutes and 10 seconds after the pyrotechnic display, there are exactly 3 medical doctors and 1 EMT standing around Jeff. So who needs Carlos to the rescue? The official story about Carlos being Jeff's first responder and being the point man for Jeff's tourniquets is demonstrably false at this point. Let's keep following Carlos. There he is at the right at 2 minutes and 14 seconds after the pyrotechnic. Okay, we have some more video. We see Carlos still working on the fencing. Then we see this guy walk up, who I call a scene director, and he talks to Carlos, gives Carlos some instructions. Now a man in a yellow jacket hands Carlos a large flag. Here, you like flags, hold this. Dr. Panter steps out to talk to a cop, and the same man in the yellow jacket motions Panter back with 4 waves of his hand. Again in slow motion, waving Panter back, not looking directly at Panter, discreetly telling Panter to get back into his place on the stage. Now the guy taps Carlos, takes the flag back from Carlos, and converses with Carlos. And there they are at 2 minutes and 39 seconds after the pyrotechnic display. No tourniquets yet for poor Jeff. Ha Ha Tango caught them standing there also. A few seconds later, in the next Ha Ha Tango photo, Carlos is standing alone by the pole. Maybe he's wondering where the wheelchair is for his big moment. Maybe Carlos is wondering why that empty wheelchair is being wheeled the wrong way, and why that other empty wheelchair is just sitting there. As already mentioned, According to a FEMA assessment, there was no lack of wheelchairs or stretchers near the scene. The report says, quote, volunteers and bystanders used over 100 wheelchairs and stretchers positioned around the finish line to transport victims to the medical tent, unquote. Here's a photo of a guy right near the finish line rolling a wheelchair at only 19 seconds after the pyrotechnic display. Unfortunately, he is going the wrong way. Maybe Carlos is wondering if anyone has thought to put tourniquets on Jeff's legs in all this time. I should mention that the use of tourniquets was highly commended all around in the days and weeks after the Boston unbombing. So let's consider Carlos' story that he and Dr. Panther quickly put tourniquets on Jeff before Carlos whisked Jeff off on the first available wheelchair. Here we see that Carlos has not gotten to Jeff yet, but we have already seen that Dr. Panther and an EMT were standing directly over Jeff at just over 1 minute after the pyrotechnic display. And we saw the paramedic retrieve his medical bag and bring it right back to Dr. Panther and Jeff. Here they are. Surely the Boston EMT knew that tourniquets would be essential for Jeff. Here's the basic treatment protocol for victims of explosions. Quote, limbs that are partially or completely amputated should be treated with the application of a tourniquet. It's just common sense. Then at almost 2.5 minutes after the pyrotechnic display, we saw 4 medical professionals, 3 doctors and an EMT, standing in a circle around Jeff. So has anyone put tourniquets on Jeff by now? The answer is no. Half a minute after the previous photo, the man on the left, circled and indicated by the blue arrow, comes onto the scene for the first time. He was not there before, but he is entering now, and he is easy to spot wearing a white visor. Note that he is also wearing camouflage pants and tan boots. Another half minute passes, and we see that the man in the white visor and camouflage pants and tan boots is now standing very close to Jeff. Note that a woman is being taken out on a stretcher. Her name is Mary Daniel, and she was right next to Jeff on the bricks. You might not have noticed her next to Jeff in this video frame showing Jeff between Dr. Panther and the EMT. There she is. Mary Daniel is being taken away on a stretcher, so there will now be an empty spot where she was on the bricks. Here is where we find out if anyone has put tourniquets on Jeff yet. This photo, which we've already seen, was taken just after Mary Daniel was removed, and here we see that the guy with the camouflage pants and tan boots has arrived near Jeff. Here we clearly see that there is no tourniquet on Jeff's exposed left leg. His other leg is partially wrapped in Dr. Panther's jacket, but clearly his left leg has not received a tourniquet, which completely contradicts the official story and also contradicts common sense, given the number of medical professionals seen surrounding Jeff up to this moment. As already pointed out, one other thing we notice in this picture is a tube coming out of the back of Jeff's shorts. Well, well, well. Holy moly. Nobody at the scene cares about getting a tourniquet onto Jeff because everybody knows that Jeff is a crisis actor. Remember that Carlos said that when he reached Jeff, he saw that a lot of blood was coming out of Jeff's legs. There is no way that a bunch of medical professionals wouldn't think to put tourniquets on Jeff's legs. It really is common sense. Just for perspective, consider this news report about a kayaker who had his foot bitten off by a shark. His friend put a makeshift tourniquet on his leg, and a nearby charter boat rushed him back to the dock, but he still bled to death before even reaching the dock. By the way, I forgot to mention who took this photo of the non-tourniqueted Jeff lying on the ground at 3 minutes after the pyrotechnic display. I'll give you one guess. You guessed it. Cowboy Carlos took this photo. The image at the top left is from the video clip we saw of Carlos displaying his camera to an interviewer. Compare the photo of the camera to the photo at the bottom right. I labeled a few of the identical features. It's definitely the same photo. You may recall that Carlos told the Florida Sun Sentinel that he quickly snapped 5 photos just after jumping over the fence. In reality, Carlos took this photo almost 2.5 minutes after he jumped the fence. And he released the photo to the public that very day, within mere hours after the unbombing, as the screenshots at the bottom show. Again, aside from the lack of tourniquets, the most revealing feature is the tube coming out of Jeff's clothes above his thigh. Okay, so back to this picture at 3:10 after the pyrotechnic display. In this photo, we see that Carlos has finally arrived near the non-tourniqueted Jeff around the same time as the guy with the white visor and camo pants and tan boots. Now, if you think that Jeff will be getting out on a wheelchair anytime soon, then think again. As an overview of the whole scene at this point, we see that the area is fairly flooded with first responder medical professionals of all stripes. I should also note that by now, several crisis actor victims have already been taken away by wheelchair or by stretcher. Some were wheelchaired out or walked out by way of the sidewalk, as indicated by the yellow arrow on the left, and some by way of the street, as indicated by the green arrow on the right.
Remember, when people are criticizing honest questioning of an official narrative, make sure they're using facts and evidence. If instead you're hearing name-calling and adjectives describing an emotional response without addressing anything specific, that's usually an indicator of a prejudice. In 2014, the late David McGowan was a guest on In Other News, discussing his similar forensic photographic analysis of the Boston Marathon bombing. Let's go now to some of that interview to bring continuity into this much-needed investigation. Now, in your photo analysis of the Boston Marathon bombing, there are so many anomalies, and you notice people who should have been covered in blood and were not, and specifically the individual near the person with both legs that appeared to be severed below the knee. Tell us about that particular scene.
That's the Jeff Bowman guy we are to believe had both of his legs traumatically amputated, and who was rolled off in a wheelchair and widely photographed and videotaped. Of course, those images were shoved in our faces to a pretty incredible degree after the event. Yeah, I mean, everything about him, as far as the photographic record is concerned, just does not add up. There were a number of people who claimed to have tended to him, and people in the photographs who could be seen around him. Yeah, there is a noticeable lack of blood on these people. You know, there was an incident in New York, I believe in December, where there was this weird freak accident where a taxi like jumped the curb and clipped off some woman, some tourist's foot. Actually, the car actually amputated her foot. And weirdly enough, one of the first guys on the scene was none other than Dr. Oz, famous TV doctor. I have a quote from him saying there was a very limited window that they had to save this woman's life, because when a leg or a portion of a leg is blown off like that, and he was quoted in the newspaper as saying, and I don't have it in front of me, but essentially what he said was, when that happens, that femoral artery is going to start spraying like a garden hose. And it's weird to believe that Jeff Bowman had both of his legs completely blown off, you know, like above the knee, or one just under the knee and one above the knee. Now, this woman just lost a foot, and we're being told that the blood would be spraying out like a garden hose, and you would have a very limited window to save her life, to stop that flow and save her life. And yet, this guy supposedly lost both of his legs, and the doctor who tended to him was this guy by the name of Dr. Painter, and who was interviewed quite a bit by the media afterwards. And you can see him in the pictures, you know, wandering among the alleged victims. And he had on like this bright yellow, dress shirt. And he did not even bother to roll up the sleeves, you know, of his shirt. And I think he had on like some khaki trousers or something. we're supposed to believe that this guy performed emergency triage on this guy who had just lost had both of his legs blown off and, you know, would have therefore been just spewing blood everywhere. And you can see in the pictures he did, in fact, tend to him to some degree. Walked away from that scene without so much as a speck of blood on him. Just spotlessly clean sleeves on his shirt, you know, no blood on his hands, no blood anywhere. And that was true of every single one of the responders. Every person who, you know, claimed to or can be seen in the images tending to these victims, they all walked away without a drop of blood on them. There was this another guy, Dr. Levine, who was like a doppelganger for Steven Spielberg. It's kind of uncanny in the images how closely he resembles Spielberg. But again, you know, this is a guy who tended to a number of victims, severely injured, you know, supposedly. Guy was wearing like a white jacket, you know, and same thing, walked away without a speck of blood on him. And every single one of the responders, I mean, I have pictures of all of these people, high-definition pictures of this whole scene unfolding. And there's not a single responder who walked away from that scene with, like, so much as even a drop of blood on them. And yet, we're told that something like 15 limbs were blown off that day in this very small, isolated patch of pavement. There were supposedly 15 limbs that were lost that day, which means, you know, the equivalent of like having 15 garden hoses spraying blood all over this scene. And yet every single person who gave aid or comfort to these victims walked away with no blood on them, you know. And that's just, there's just no way that that could have actually happened. It's also quite noticeable that none of the medical responders, the trained medical responders, the doctors, nurses, emergency personnel, paramedics, whatever, none of them took any kind of normal precautions that you would think that they would have taken when dealing with that much blood and the threat of bloodborne pathogens. A lot of them aren't even wearing gloves. Some of them are, but a lot of them aren't. And none of them, not a single person, could be seen wearing, like, eye protection or any kind of face protection, face mask or anything like that. Even though medical supplies were readily available, they had a very large, fully stocked medical tent just yards from where the blast went off at the end of the marathon route. And there were just scores of ambulances lined up. So there was no shortage of supplies, and yet none of these people, trained professionals, took the most basic precautions, you know. I mean, we live in an era where my family dentist won't even drill my teeth without, like, putting on a hazmat suit, practically, you know. Wow. He wears eye protection and face mask and everything because they're very real threats. And yet these people were operating in a theater where, you know, 15 garden hoses were spraying blood all over the place. And that's in addition to scores of other people who suffered other grave injuries that fell short of amputation, but, you know, very serious injuries. And all these people are wandering around the scene without taking any kind of precautions to protect themselves from contamination. And all of them walked away blood free. That's just impossible for that to happen if this was in fact a real event. These were in fact real victims.
Good point.
And that's just one factor out of many, you know, the anomalies that can be detected in these images. But that is one of the main ones. I mean, that's a huge smoking gun right there. Is, you know, how do you explain the fact that all of these people walked away without any blood on them, and none of them took any kind of normal precautions that a medical professional would normally take before entering into that scene?
That's a very odd anomaly to look at. However, it seems if it were a staged event and these individuals were crisis actors that were involved here, they're relying on people not paying attention. I got another question for you. And specifically the two women, you did an interesting expose on investigating the images of the women who initially appeared side by side in a pool of red liquid, one with their legs sort of bent up unnaturally. What can you tell us about these women who were photographed a bit later on stretchers?
It was supposed to be Crystal Campbell and her friend, whose name was Karen Rand, I believe. The one image that showed that you were referring to, which shows the two of them in the foreground, their eyes closed, and was very widely circulated, and it was generally claimed that Crystal Campbell was actually deceased in the image, that she was that she had already passed, you know, because her eyes are closed. She looks very much like she could be, and her legs, as you said, are very unnatural angles. They look like, one of them looks like it could possibly even be severed. As these pictures circulated, there, that was widely claimed, in fact, that the picture depicted her as deceased, and also that one of her legs was severed. And in fact, a lot of people were quite outraged at that picture, that think that image should be circulated, because it was widely believed that it did show her dead. But that's not actually the case, because there was another picture taken right after where her eyes are open and she's looking up at the nurse that's tending to her, and in fact appears to be smiling, actually. And then there's later pictures of her on the stretcher with her legs having been magically restored and in a normal orientation, you know, and not showing significant injury. You know, there's blood and whatnot, but her legs are obviously intact and attached and not in the condition that they appear to be in that first picture. And that picture appears very much to have been posed.
That was part of an interview with the late David McGowan, a deep investigator of false flag and staged events. This aired back in April of 2014, and at the time, he was working construction, and he did the interview from his vehicle during his lunch break. But here you have important corroborating analysis from two separate reports. You heard the Dr. Oz quote about arteries gushing like garden hoses, and David's point that there would be 15 garden hoses spraying blood and splattering clothing of those responding to the injuries. The state news reported that bombs went off, killing 3 people and wounding more than 260 people. We know now that this report is most likely not true because of all the complicated staging and moulage deployed in the immediate aftermath of the first blast. So what could have exploded at the Boston Marathon in 2013? Let's hear about how easily the two blasts could have been simulated.
The official story is that the pressure cooker bomb was loaded with black powder, also called gunpowder, which is categorized as a low explosive or low order explosive. Low explosives, when used in a pressure cooker bomb, can be horrifically destructive, but they simply do not generate the kind of blast that can knock you off a couch inside a third-floor office at the distance Mendelssohn claims to have been. On the other hand, high-energy explosive materials create a supersonic blast wave of pressurized air that can knock people down at a distance well beyond the incendiary zone. If there had been a high-order explosive detonation, then yes, there would have been a huge knock-you-down blast wave, and there would have also been a crater in the sidewalk and a wide ring of dead bodies around the detonation site. God forbid. Just by analyzing the footage, you can see that plenty of people who were actually close to the pyrotechnic remained standing. Both of these images are from 1 second after the pyrotechnic display. Lots of people on the sidewalk are still standing. Why didn't all the people in the street get knocked over by a blast wave? No one on the street fell over excepting one old fellow named Bill Ifrig, who was a member of the crisis actor crew. Actually, there was also a guy over in the bleachers who said he was knocked over by a blast wave. Like Bruce Mendelssohn, John Mixon was allowed to run onto the scene and play hero. In the article here from the Portland Press Herald, Mixon says that the blast wave knocked him right out of the bleachers. There was no bomb. But we all saw something go boom, so let's briefly consider the question of how it's possible that what we saw wasn't a bomb. Is it possible that special effects experts could conduct a fairly convincing simulated explosion in a crowded area without injuring anyone? The answer is yes. They do it in the movies all the time, and also in military training battlefield simulations, as featured on this slide. And they also do it on stages at entertainment events. I should also mention that there are all kinds of explosion simulation effects which don't use gunpowder at all. There are pneumatic compressed air mechanisms, there are smoke machines, which come in a variety of shapes and sizes, and there are cryogenic CO2 jets. Often several different effects devices are used simultaneously in combination. Just add a well-timed flash of bright yellowish or orangish light to simulate a flaming core. The area within the railings would have been an ideal area for explosion simulation mechanisms, including smoke machines and cryogenic CO2 smoke jets. They could have possibly hidden pipes within the railings, or they could have possibly utilized the built-in metal pipe sticking out of the sidewalk in front of the building. Again, I'm only talking possibilities here, just to make the point that simulating a bomb explosion at the site would not have been beyond the ability of special effects professionals. It's worth noting that in the 6th and 7th and 8th Thorndike photos, we see a guy reaching under a board that appears to have a hole in it, and he picks something up from under the board. It looks like he's grabbing onto a handle. Could be a smoke machine. Could be a smoke machine disguised in a black bag. Just talking possibilities.
Author and novelist Professor Eric Larson writes in The Skull of Yurik, "The emptiness of American thinking in a time of grave peril studies in the cover-up of 9/11. Quote, "And so we come toward our end by returning to the great question that caused all of this searching. Can there be a literary life in a post-1984 nation? Can there be a literary life in a nation of the kind the United States has become over the past few decades, especially since 9/11? The answer is very clear. No, there can't and won't be a literary life in such a time and place, nor will there be the production of a literature of depth, complexity, authenticity, significance, or durability. Why not? Because the creation of a true, real, or significant literature is impossible when a people lives or is forced to live in ignorance of the whole truth of their own lives, of their nation's life, and of the lives of those they live among. For so long as Americans continue to be deprived of or continue to be conditioned into an inability to see and know at least half of the truth of what their own lives are, and at least half of the truth of what their own nation is and is doing, they will remain at the very best half people, living half lives in half blindness, and thinking in half thought." End quote. Let's hear some of the interview from past guest Professor Eric Larson about what it means to quietly and comfortably live your life in a country that is waging war on multiple fronts in your name. Professor Eric Larson, you've written exhaustively about the concerns of the American public and how they're thinking. You call it infantilism. Can you just describe again what that is?
Yeah, I can try to, and I think I can. It's an unhappy subject. One way in which it works, and this is the less awful way, but one way is in the, as we were mentioning before, the placing of confidence in people in order to reinforce their lack of confidence. But in A Nation Gone Blind, the book I wrote in 2006, I call that dumb rights. And it's very, it's not completely off the wall to say that Americans tend very much to value and cherish their dumb rights. Okay, but we've talked about that already, and people are flattered for their dumbness, and that does not help anyone except the cover-up camp. And so that is a form of being and being infantilized and being maintained as an infantilized person. You know, sort of, boy, I'm good, I'm great, I'm dumb. You laugh at a dumb person sort of like you do at a little kid because they're innocent. But in this case, it's not a matter of innocence. But worse is the same phenomenon, but on a scale far, far larger. It extends throughout all of the arts, throughout all of American literature, throughout all of American journalism. It's part of the whole dumbing down process and principle that we've been reading and talking about for the last 20 years. But it's creeping in, has crept into the most serious echelons and levels of the artistic cultural establishment. There cannot be a serious political book published in America today by any commercial publishing house. There can be published by little tiny presses, but not very many of those. I only know of one. That's mine.
Oliver Arts.
The Oliver Arts and Open Press, which will not judge any work on the grounds of its breaking of barriers in speaking on what may have been considered or are considered taboos. Well, let me put it this way. When Frank Rich, I think this was back in 07, reviewed a book by Dan DeLillo, and the book was called Falling Man. And the title of the book came from a character who was going around New York City and falling, deliberately falling, from places like train trestles and such, to be arrested by a bungee cord. And this was extremely shocking in the book to people who were observing him because it reminded them of the falling man or the falling people coming out of the World Trade Center on 9/11. Well, take it from me. The book is terrible. It's an awful book in many ways. If you're interested in the details, pick up The Skull of Yorick and read the last chapter. But Frank Rich took the book and he ran a front page review of it in the New York Review of Books with such high praise that it's just astonishing. And if you read his essay, you read remarks made by DeLillo, they're just being silly. They're being so... I make the parallel between their behavior and the behavior of little circus dogs in tutus dancing for the dog master. They're saying absurdities. They're singing praises of things that ought to be condemned by everyone, like the beauty of destruction, the upliftingness of catastrophe. You read that, and then read it in the context of someone who criticizes it. I think it's terrifying. And that's infantilism of an aggressive and a mean, a destructive kind. Then there's the infantilism of contentlessness, whereby a writer who Tom Engelhart particularly likes, named Rebecca Solnit, I find her a perfect example of the empty progressive writer. She's just empty. In part five, in what I call impotence writing, where the sound or the appearance of significance passes for significance, something like that. But it seems to me that that's the kind of writing that...
I think I have it here.
Yeah.
Because this is a really good paragraph. Here it is. It lies with us thanks to our impotence thinking and our impotence writing, where sounding good passes itself off as doing good.
Sounding good passes itself off as doing good. I remember a review that Dwight Garner ran in the Times. Now, I'm not going to be good at this name, the name of the book or of its author. It's sometime back, and the book didn't come up to the promise. It was overlauded. But the glee and the silliness and the Hollywoodization of Garner's treatment of that book, because it was so-called a 9/11 book, were shocking. Just shocking. And it's a little bit like the Roger Cohen sentimentalizing 9/11 in the Times also. So these are aspects of people not just not thinking, but agreeing that they're not supposed to think, and therefore thinking stupidly within their not thinking parameters. It's a little bit like taking the vitamins out of a baby's food or formula, and I don't know what happens then. It's not good. But the baby doesn't die, but the baby doesn't talk as well, think as well. It doesn't ever become an adult. I think in the New York Times, Tom Friedman is another one. Dwight Garner are, in many, many a way, infantilized writers. Their deaths described him more fully in As the Skull of Yorick as well.
In that essay of infantilism, I think it's Delusional America, 9/11.
Yeah, yeah.
You write, living in an environment of deceit, fraud, and deception and lies has carried the American population to an even higher plateau of infection, debility, blindness, and handicap. In short, Americans have begun going insane. Well, is that in the defense of American people?
No, it's not. I think the insanity... I walk down the streets. In fact, I was walking down the street just this afternoon and observing people, and I notice how comfortable they often are, and how they are involved in their daily affairs. They're talking with their children and they're talking to one another. And there's nothing wrong with that. Heaven knows there's nothing wrong with that. But at the same time, the nation that they are citizens of is set upon destroying the earth, or very nearly destroying the earth at this point, waging how many wars by count? Shall we begin to count the wars? Like Elizabeth Barrett said, let me count the ways. How much do I love thee? Let me count the ways. Well, we could count the wars, could we not, with the prospect of more to come. For what? Well, these are wars that are essentially, they're territorial resource wars. They're wars against people and peoples. They're wars against nations. Our nation is now the worst on the earth. It's the most aggressive, the most destructive, the most intolerant, the most unfair. And we, as a people, technically, on paper, enjoy perhaps the fewest freedoms of anyone in the world. Certainly not protected by habeas corpus, not protected from the will of a president who may choose to arrest us and put us away forever without any evidence or any hearing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're spied on, we're threatened. Why? Well, how can it be that these things have happened to us and we're letting them happen if we're not insane? Isn't it insanity to go on living a regular life without taking heed of these immensities of destruction? To me, it's an emergency, to put it lightly.
That was part of an interview with Professor Eric Larson. There is a steep price being paid right now for living blindly in a heavily propagandized country. It is because of this blindness that the people involved in the various false flag staged events are confident justice won't be served. As we listen without scrutiny to the serpent songs in America, we will continue to build their confidence that nothing will be done. The narrator in the Boston unbombing closes the documentary discussing how it's possible the crisis actors were coerced into participating. He says, quote, there are some serious psychopaths and sociopaths down in the U.S. deep state crawling along a criminal web extending through various governmental agencies and military channels and headquarters of financial cartels and corporate conglomerates, making use of patsies. Lying and murder is everyday work for such criminals, not to mention unleashing hellish chaos upon entire nations. Often we hear about some people hating our freedom. What they really hate is our CIA and State Department. End quote. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again Monday, 11 p.m. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.